Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you. I'm very honoured to be here today to speak to such an eminent audience and also to listen to the speakers and learn more about this important area. Also here in Earl's Court, arguably the heartland of some of the good, bad and ugly of my co-patriots for many years. Thank you for inviting me. It also is a great pleasure to me for me to share with you some of the lessons that I have learnt over a 25-year career as the director of the Kirkton Road Centre in Sydney's King's Cross, often learnt the hard way. My own background is in public health medicine and I also hold specialist qualifications in addiction medicine. We always take every opportunity, of course, to show off our beautiful city, but also to show how close King's Cross is to the central business district of Sydney, and it's been the centre of the sex and drugs industries arguably since day one, being quite close to the port of Sydney, and we've been, of course, it was considered very necessary in the 80s to have a public health unit in this area to stem HIV and other transmissible infections in the populations of homeless people who inject drugs, at-risk young people and sex workers who dwell in this area and have done so for many years. Looking across down into the main street of King's Cross, we're directly opposite the largest neon Coca-Cola sign in the Southern Hemisphere. We're lucky in the Southern Hemisphere we often get to be the biggest. This is where the Kirkton Road Centre is actually where the headquarters are. It's actually still an operating fire station down on the ground floor. We had the first, second and third floors, arguably also putting out fires, but of a different sort. As I've already flagged, I'm speaking from my experience over this 25 years, also as the founding medical director for eight of those 25 years of Sydney's first and still only medically supervised injecting centre. Dating back to the mid-90s, I guess it was, when increasingly the local community started questioning services of our nature, harm reduction services, and I'm hoping, I suppose, that our experience in defending these services will also have relevance to other services that are established for people who are increasingly considered undesirable by communities, and as we heard from some of the speakers this morning, by no, there's evidence to suggest that if anything in these harder times, that our communities are becoming less tolerant, not more tolerant, of vulnerable marginalised populations such as those that we target at the Kirkton Road Centre. This sign here was on every telegraph pole back in 1996. When we opened a second facility on the main street called K2, which was an over-the-counter needle syringe service, which has subsequently been relocated. So that was our first experience of a very public campaign that also found its way into the media and, of course, involved local politicians and was quite a storm. The peaked roof there is the location also on the same main street of King's Cross, where now the medically supervised injecting facility is located. There you see it at 66. Similarly, a sort of frosted glass, innocuous sort of frontage, quite deliberately designed that way so it's not immediately apparent what actually happens there. Must say, when I took that photo, I didn't realise there was that sign of, for the police to sort of head the other in the other direction. This is very, very faint. You might not be able to see it, but it actually says 666 at 66. That was one of those kind messages that somebody left given our specific street address of 66. The injecting centre actually is a one-way facility. You come in from the main street, you go through three stages and exit through the back. There we've got Talk of the Town at the back, which is one of the many brothels in the area, but I think we certainly competed for that title for many years as, you know, controversy continued to rage on about the value of this. But particularly it was the location of this facility that was mostly being debated. As mentioned, the Chamber of Commerce in particular were very not only vocal opponents but actually took us to the Supreme Court on several occasions to try to prevent us opening the facility, headed up by a barrister who was able to, of course, represent them free of charge. Here we have the door to Kirkton Road Centre. You see there a vending machine on the front door and a disposal vessel next to it for used needle syringes. We've also had battles, not necessarily in relation to this particular machine, but the establishment of other machines elsewhere have also attracted controversy. K2I, I showed the slide before, has been relocated now to Victoria Street to a clinic that we now call Clinic 180, and you see it there. It's a three-storey terrace house where we provide needle syringe services and also clinical services. And that also was met with great community opposition. So it's from those sorts of experiences over this period of time that I am here today to talk about some of the lessons learnt. When I first sort of developed the list, it was about 25 long. I have managed to concentrate it a bit given the time restraints today. Here's another one of those lovely messages that we found in our suggestion box. I'm not sure what that last word is, but I don't think it's good. But the Rosebank Residents Action Group did actually have a membership of one who has very nice handwriting, and she's been on my case now for the full 25 years that I've been operating, and I do kind of wonder whether or not she might not consider another suburb to live in, since clearly, despite not having a lot of success in closing us down, she's still obviously maintaining the rage. But seriously, though, we know there's a lot of evidence for harm reduction strategies, particularly methadone treatment and needle syringe services, and now there's also a mountain of evidence for the effectiveness of actually supervising injecting in a clinical setting. But that's all good and well if we're unable to host these facilities in communities that are affected, then we are obviously going to have, you know, no success in achieving the sort of aims that we're hoping for. So it's very important that we're able to not only establish these facilities in communities, but also to be able to sustain them across time. So some of the do's and don'ts I've put up front here, garnering political support. Often I think politicians themselves aren't always even aware of just how powerful they are in terms of being able to support public health initiatives. And it's very important, I think, as our chair said, that we develop relationships also with media. I'll talk about that in a moment, but particularly with local politicians, so that they do understand fully what the evidence base is and the importance of these programs. Providing relevant evidence. Recently, there was a storm around another needle vending machine in another area with very high rates of drug use, and they held a community meeting, and they had a lot of very high-ranking professors presenting about the global AIDS crisis with beautiful PowerPoint presentations. In my experience, that's not the evidence necessarily that local communities want to hear about. What they want to hear about is what the local impacts are going to be and how you're going to be able to mitigate those impacts and what the evidence is for the success of such mitigation strategies. Mobilising other expert voices. Sadly, people like myself are often seen to have a vested interest. It's as though they think I wouldn't be able to get another job were it not for the drug problem. And it's even been suggested, I'll show you a slide in a moment, that maybe we even have a vested interest in not solving the drug problem so that we keep ourselves from becoming homeless. So mobilising other expert voices is also important, and again making sure that those voices are very articulate and not too lofty in the way that they explain what it is that we're doing. Communicating information effectively, so that sort of dovetails into that, so keeping it plain. Showing that you care and speaking from the heart, I think that's important from this morning too. We've heard advice that we should try to humanise the stories, so rather than showing, you know, graphs with p-values and so on, to actually put a face on who we're talking about is very vital in advocating for services like this. So this is a slide that I was referring to. This is in the Hansard. This is just one of the many speeches where I get a special mention. And here you see that the wife of the MP for Castle Hill has a view. So here he goes on to say that how many people have been encouraged because of my team of so-called health professionals willing to bet. This was when, in fact, they put a clause, an extra clause into the legislation around the injecting centre that said that if the utilisation dropped below 75% of what it was at that time, that that would trigger an economic review of the service. I should add that the service had already been subject to 3 economic reviews, and of course as a public health physician I think it's very important that we demonstrate that we use scarce public health resources as effectively and as efficiently as possible. I just wish I saw similar reviews happening in the big hospitals, where of course we don't see so much of that in relation to the very high cost services provided there. And subsequently there have been 2 more economic reviews of this service. But the 75% number 2 again was just picked out of the air. It did seem to suggest though that under 75% we wouldn't be able to demonstrate cost benefit, which also was not the case. But here his wife immediately suggested that staff would be pulling people in off the street to get them to inject inside the injecting room so that we could maintain our jobs. We actually call that outreach. And we actually do this unashamedly, encouraging people to come in and use our services instead of injecting in back streets, where, of course, if somebody overdoses, it's in the lap of the gods as to whether or not anybody notices that, whether or not the ambulance is called, whether they come in time and whether they're successfully resuscitated. And even when they are, of course, 20 minutes down the track, without oxygen to the brain, as we know, that's not exactly good for your cognitive function and other major organ functioning. Respecting the community's intelligence is it sort of sounds obvious, but again, I think sometimes people like me live in something of a bubble and spend a lot of time talking with like-minded people and assume often that others won't agree or understand as well as we do. I have found that if you do spend the time explaining things to people, as already in the previous points, people do get it. But you have to be patient with that and allow people to actually integrate and digest the information. But by and large, when you do show respect for people's intelligence, eventually people will swing across and support you. Developing a relationship with media, absolutely essential, particularly local media is important, but also state-based and national media, although we found in our case that particularly the Daily Telegraph, which is the highest, most read newspaper in Australia, run by one of our famous imports to this country as well, had a news policy that they would never support harm reduction or the injecting centre because they said that's not what their readers wanted to hear about, and that they did not believe that their readers would ever support such a thing. So it's interesting that they don't even pretend that they have a role in informing their readership, and that news is something sort of a bit more pure. It's one thing for the op-eds to run a particular line, but that the actual news... So we haven't really ever hoped to get them on side, But we did develop very close relationships with media, and again, that's about investing the time, as already suggested, being able to package information in such a way that it is easily understood and also able to be used, providing, you know, other people to speak to the media so that it's very easy for them to ring those people and get an opinion to offset the, you know, the balance that media seem very addicted to, where, you know, they simply can't run a story that's based on evidence and has a whole bunch of people saying something is a good thing. Always have to go and find the person that's ready to stand there and say it's a terrible thing. So, and also getting media training. So particularly those of us who have been on that front line as the warriors myself, and also cover for me, so if I'm overseas or whatever, so that we have somebody who's always available who has media training, who can stand in front of the cameras and explain, because sometimes these things come up very quickly and, you know, you have to be able to respond quickly as well. Here you see some of the examples of some of the charming stories that have been written about us. Also, this one I just mentioned this very quickly. Diabetic cat brings needle case unstuck. On one occasion, it was teeming rain, and someone knocked on the front door and said, there's a bin out the back of the injecting centre with literally thousands of needles falling out of it. And a very suspicious-looking man with a big camera taking photos of that, who also did turn out to be from the Daily Telegraph. And I did know, of course, it was suspected that he had set that up, but I knew from the start that if they were going to set that up, they never would have done so on a day like that. It was so inclement, I almost felt sorry for the photographer. But despite the fact that we explained to him that, of course, this could not have emanated from an injecting centre, I mean, one of the objectives of an injecting centre is that people go in, they inject, and they leave their injecting equipment behind, and we, of course, safely dispose of it, and we would have absolutely no interest, of course, in then, you know, instead putting it in, you know, in a bin out the back. The fact that also the brand of needles was different to the brand that is distributed through needle syringe programs did not stop the newspaper from proceeding with a front page spread of deadly neglect. So not only were we not credited for addressing public health issues, we were actually being accused of creating a public health hazard for the local community. As it turned out, there was somebody moving out the back street, moving house, who had a cat named Trotsky, interestingly, who was diabetic, and they had left their boxes of needles on the front stoop as part of the removal, and another member of the Chamber of Commerce had seen this as a great opportunity and had taken those needles and emptied them into the bin, and then kindly rung the Daily Telegraph, who provided a photographer, and ran a story for several days. Anyway, as you can imagine, the owner of a cat called Trotsky might well be quite supportive of service like our own, and he did feel absolutely mortified when he looked at all of this press that raged on and suddenly put two and two together and realised that was where his needles had gone in the course of the move. So then it was a scoop. And Media Watch, I don't know if you have a similar program here, but that's like on our ABC, that exposed kind of media things like this, ran it in its sort of best sort of exposures of a shocking example of poor media. And although they never apologised for accusing us of deadly neglect, the editor of the Daily Telegraph did wish the cat well. Joining every community committee that's around, and in our particular community we have lots of committees, and being interested, genuinely interested, in the other things that are happening, so that you're not just seen as this kind of person that's kind of flown in from elsewhere. You are a bona fide member of that community. So I know a lot about pavements, about elm trees versus plane trees, the allergenicity thereof, garbage collection, rats and drains, and all of those issues, because I have sat on every committee in that area for the last 25 years. And by doing so, though, of course, I guess, you know, obviously, you know, people are, convinced that I am genuinely committed to that community, and also they're ready to hear about issues, you know, sooner rather than later as they arise. Establishing your own community committee, and not necessarily just having members that are going to be sort of friends, but also, you know, bringing in people who are potentially antagonistic towards your service. So again, you have the opportunity to get to know those people and explain in greater depth what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it. As I mentioned before, focusing on local impacts, that's what local communities are the most interested in, but that's of course not to say that we shouldn't also talk about the greater good and how this fits into a bigger strategy. Often what we find is that people think it's only them, so they might well think, well, we can understand the evidence and we appreciate that we need to have this sort of thing here, but if we have this here, you know, we're happy enough to own the good, the bad and the ugly of our community, but what about those other people that will then start coming into our area? I found once I explained to people in King's Cross that there are in fact 800 needle syringe programs throughout New South Wales, the state that then sort of did reassure people that it wasn't just them bearing the burden in this regard. Of course, the injecting centre, however, does remain the only one in the country, and that's likely to continue to be the case. Prioritising local residents' issues and including other sectors so that this is not just a health thing. We've heard eloquent speeches this morning again, particularly about how important housing is, education department and community services. These are all important players. Consider community forums to explain when things really get hot, but then again, best not to do community forums when it is really hot, because it's a very public place to fail. Again, you know, having public speaking training or media training, and being able to structure those forums so that you discourage them turning into disintegrating into some sort of rabble is very important, because that can actually do more harm than good. So I think there is a place for this sort of thing, but they need to be well organised. And of course, making sure that you also get voices there that are supportive, because generally speaking, community forums will attract people who are the noisiest and feel the most strongly about things, and particularly if local politicians come, they can often be forgiven for thinking there really is a sort of community crisis, whereas in fact the vast majority of people in our local community are actually sort of sitting at home and watching TV most evenings, and couldn't think of anything worse than coming to a community forum. So we've actually found that doing telephone polling to get community opinion in the local area is an important way to communicate to politicians about the support for your service, and also that's the sort of evidence that politicians readily understand. And we've been able to show that even though there's been some, you know, very sort of lively debates at community forums, that they certainly don't necessarily represent the views of the broader community in that area. Don't dismiss adversarial views, be respectful and keep turning the other cheek. The sort of dynamic in community meetings I've found is that usually even some of the people that sort of hate your service the most, there's still a sense of fair go. And if they see you being attacked over and over, that if anything will help your cause. So, you know, you need to have some good support structures and debriefing afterwards with your friends or family or whatever, but never in a public situation attack the person or give as good as you're getting. And as I say, if anything, it will stand you in good stead if you're seen to be respectful and dignified in the face of aggression and ugliness, particularly if the attacks become personal, which also has been known to happen. Try to find the common ground, but that said, not to agree to something that will set up your program to failure. So I've seen this happen as well, where there's been these sort of compromises made, again in relation to this vending machine that was put on a wall in a neighbouring suburb that got lots of lots of displeasure from the community there. They agreed to put a CCTV up and a big light on the machine so that it would be safe at night time as a result. Yes, there's been no antisocial behaviour associated with that machine, but no one's actually used the machine either. So, you know, agreeing to those sorts of things when really there's no evidence that, you know, there is increased crime in the immediate vicinity of things like vending machines, that was not a good compromise to make. And I also, just picking up on what was said this morning, I think economic arguments are good, but never to just justify your programs on that basis. I think it is very much a slippery slope. And I guess, you know, that dovetails into the notion of do not apologise for what you do. So I think, you know, that's also sometimes tempting, but, you know, what we do is a good thing. And I think that moral arguments should be progressed. Often that's what we're up against, people making values-based moral judgments about the people that harm reduction services see. And I think they should be countered with, well, you know, what do you think is a better approach? So what you think, people dying in back streets is all right. So I think really being quite confronting about that reality is an important thing to go hand in hand with the sort of objective evidence, including sometimes the economic arguments. Knowing your opposition, in our case, the Chamber of Commerce was headed up by this barrister I mentioned before. When I actually sort of sat him down early in the piece to talk about what his opposition was and how I could address that, he admitted to me that he'd stood as an independent state member in the last election and gotten 28 votes, and he thought he needed to raise his profile, and he figured this was going to be a high-profile, controversial program, and he said, you know, sorry, Darlin, but I'm here for the ride. And that was good. I mean, I did appreciate his frankness, and that way I didn't waste any more time trying to, you know, prosecute arguments with this particular organisation, because I knew that they had that as their motivation. I should add, in the next election he stood again, and I stood and get up to the triple figures. So I guess he mistook infamy for fame, and it certainly didn't translate into support. Offer to pilot initiatives. That does reassure people who are just plain anxious about new initiatives. And, you know, you can understand why people, again, might be anxious about something like, you know, a new thing coming into the area, particularly in the case of the injecting centre. We hadn't had one of those before in the country. But using that as an example as well, have an exit strategy, and I would suggest it should never go for more than 12 months. That injecting centre was a trial for 9.5 years, I think one of the longest scientific trials ever to operate. And it wasn't for lack of evidence that it went on for that long originally. It was slated for 18 months. It was just all political. They just kept on extending it. And anyway, finally, in the last dying months of the state Labor government, they did, as part of their swan song, lift the trial status of that service. So obviously everybody's very pleased about that. Developing a plan of management to assess, monitor and review any impacts. It's a bit of extra work, but again, you get the objective evidence then to be able to come back in a year's time and show what those impacts are. And of course, there may well be impacts, and then you also get to deal with those things and minimise those things. Being open and transparent, available at all times, is also incredibly important. There's a lot of literature that shows that community outrage is not really directly related to the real risk of initiatives. It's more related to whether or not they trust the people who are charged with overseeing it. And so being open and transparent, admitting when you don't know things, but reassuring people that, you know, together you'll work something out, you know, has, again, an impact, is important as far as gaining that trust, rather than either trying to minimise it or saying, you know, trust me, I'm a doctor, so that people know they can come in through the front door. Be proactive in responding to complaints, and communicate issues with the client base as well, but do be aware of the risks. And we had a lot of media cameras on our front door, and sometimes our clients were sort of very incensed about this, and there was once or twice, even in the case of this photographer from the Daily Telegraph in the rain, we actually sort of somewhat perversely ended up having to sort of defend him against some clients who were threatening him because they were so angry because they could see exactly where all that was heading. So we've tried to discourage involvement of client base in relation to defending the service because it can get nasty for them as well. And, of course, that all ends up on the TV and isn't always such a good thing. Being willing to be flexible and modify operations, but as I said before, not make compromises that are going to set up your program for failure. So, you know, don't agree to things like CCTVs or bright lights if you know that that will make ensure that your service isn't actually used by people who, of course, have good reasons to be a bit shy of things like that. Continue the community dialogue in good times as well as the bad times. So good, you know, suddenly wanting to be friends with people to support your service if you're not also going to maintain those relationships across the quieter period. So really, again, it's about a sort of long-term nurturing of community relations, you know, also being involved in other issues that are coming up across time. And then, of course, as I've already suggested, be proud of what you do. Because, you know, working in this field, it is a great privilege. And I do believe that, you know, we are making a difference. And that's something that we should all be proud of. Thank you for listening.